Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Danelle for that news update. More news at 7 o'clock. It was Joel Greenblatt who once said that the secret to investing is to figure out the value of something and then pay a lot less. If that worked for everything, we'd all be rich. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the confirmation of Shell that they would be selling off their downstream assets to the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company as part of a 16 billion rand deal. We speak to the country chair at Shell Downstream South Africa around that and get a sense of what we make of that transaction. Then we have a conversation taking a look at National Treasury's decision to withhold finances from 70 municipalities that have failed to meet the requirements of compliance as it relates to the Municipal Finance Management Act. We also have a conversation taking a look at special economic zones following the World Bank's latest calls that South Africa should be rethinking the appropriate tax related to those special economic zones. We speak to the Distinguished Professor for Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond, and get his thoughts around that. We also have a conversation with National Gambling Board's Acting Chief Executive Officer, Lungile Dukwana, around the gambling legislation proposals and amendments that are being put forward by the DTIC in an effort to address the gambling concerns in the country. We wrap up the show with a property conversation. We're going to be taking a look at the commercial property side of things. We're going to be looking at what businesses should think about if they're looking to potentially own commercial property as opposed to renting it.
The day's markets. Clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
And that's where we kick off the show, as always, with a sense of market movements. I'm joined on the line by investment research analyst at FNB Wealth and Investments, Sithembile Bopela, to take a look at markets, see what to make of them. Sithe, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. It seems as though there were no winners in today's markets on the equities front, barring the FTSE in London. Why were markets so downbeat on a Tuesday?
Hi, Jimmy. Very good evening to you and your listeners. Yeah, today was a bit of a rough day. Hey, and yeah, we did see quite an aggressive sell-off on the local markets in the very last hour, which dragged the market near the day's lows. And that really was tracking other international markets. We did see a mixed turnout when we look at the major economic indices. We saw commodities sort of track lower after U.S. yields spiked, and our miners led the broader market lower. But industrials had a firmer close. The sector, sort of the heavyweights in the sector, sort of led the advance. We saw Naspers and Process outperform Tencent earlier today. And it was generally the dual listed names that tracked higher. And it looks more like capital sort of rotating heavily into the large industrial heavyweights. The Rand is trading softer since yesterday. And so I think it's just the Rand hedge names just doing their jobs there. But generally, you know, global tech, and this is across Asia, the US and Europe as well, had a pullback after really it was Samsung's update that failed to inject, really it was more dopamine into the system, for lack of better words. Expectations have been very high. And while, you know, we are seeing companies, and I'm speaking broadly to the tech ecosystem here, they're printing healthy numbers, but the fundamentals are just struggling to meet the sort of elevated market expectations around these stocks. And that's what's been driving today's broad market decline.
Sithembile, you touched on sector rotations potentially being the cause for why some of the market movements are taking place the way they are. And I want to get your thoughts perhaps around where we go to in terms of sectors. We've loved the AI trade. It has been all the talk for the longest time. We've finally come potentially to the end of what has been the most volatile war that we've had in recent times over the last 4 months. Where do investors start to rotate into as we kick off the second half of this year?
We go into the boring stuff, right? The stuff that's not as exciting. And so we are seeing better performance across the personal goods, especially. So you are seeing a bit of an improvement. I did mention the Rand hedge names already, but I think it is more sort of away from the overhyped tech, the AI names, the broader sort of technology enablers as well that have also been sort of running or benefiting from the AI tailwinds. And so, yeah, it's definitely what we're seeing play out across markets. And I mean, if we look internationally as well, I mean, the sort of tech-heavy NASDAQ has outperformed the rest of the markets. But when you look at something like the Russell 2000, which covers the small and mid-cap stocks across the markets there, when you look at the Dow Jones, which is the industrial average, so it's looking at the rest of the markets, is holding up relatively well, but it's just not printing as strong sort of exuberant returns because, you know, it isn't as exciting right now.
Well, I happen to think that boring is probably what we need at this point. I think we've had more than enough excitement in the markets for the last couple of months, or at least since President Trump has returned to office. Stembile, I want to take a look at the performance of the U.S. markets at the moment. The U.S. The dollar against the rand holding steady. The dollar basket, or the Dixie as we know it, still holding above that critical 100 points mark that it broke above and managed to sustain above. What do we make of where currencies are sitting at the moment, and are they still an accurate proxy or an accurate measure of where risk might be sitting in the market?
I mean, I think it's a combination of factors, right? We are now at a point where, you know, the U.S.-Iran war, there's been, you know, a sort of ceasefire agreement in place, fragile as it might be, and with repeat violations sort of keeping markets on edge, that has, you know, sort of supported sort of the wartime premium, a sort of unwind of that wartime premium. And so that's what we're seeing play out in the dollar and then subsequently across emerging currencies. As I mentioned, the rand is trading a bit weaker. That is a direct sort of consequence of that, but also a direct consequence of commodity prices pulling back as well. And so I think that, you know, markets are generally responding to the geopolitics as they have been throughout the year. And that's what we're seeing play out across the currency markets right now.
Stembile, the oil price, $74 a barrel, not where we wanted to see or where we want to see it. I thought when we got to $70 a barrel that we would potentially chase down 60. At the moment, it doesn't look that way. Of course, still very, very early in the month to tell, considering last month we recovered 20% of the move that we had lost in the war. So markets could still very realistically have a better performing rest of July. What do you make of the oil price as it stands at the moment? Are we pricing in any new risks here?
Yeah, I mean, naturally, oil markets are volatile, right? So there's always going to be sort of up and downs that, you know, the price spikes, so to speak. But I think there's been a significant unwind. I mean, the quarter started, well, the second quarter anyways, it started with Brent well above $100. And as you mentioned now, we've pulled back quite significantly. And that's been a very significant decline driven largely by the interim U.S.-Iran peace deal that set a stage for a sort of expectations for a rapid return of Persian Gulf supply, right? And so I think as that kind of plays out and sort of unwinds, we're likely to see, you know, Brent also decouple or pull back in tandem, because right now, I mean, as I mentioned, the ceasefire is quite fragile. You know, there's the strait is open, but there are still missiles flying, so we're not at all in the clear, you know, so there's definitely going to still be that sort of uncertainty and that risk premium in play.
A fragile ceasefire, market uncertainty, and perhaps it's time to start looking at the boring stocks. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. F&B Wealth and Investments' Stembile Bopela joining us to share her thoughts on markets and some of the factors that might be moving them and where we could be headed to for the second half of the year.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Africa. If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzi Leramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
For those who remember the decision by Shell to sell their downstream assets, we looked at this when it was initially announced and we wondered who would buy 600 filling stations across South Africa. Turns out a company called the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company has come out to be the top bidder and inked through a deal for those downstream assets with the team at Shell. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the country chair at Shell Downstream South Africa, Aluani Museisi, to take a look, to make sense of where we go to from here for that business and for this particular transaction. Aluani, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. A significant milestone, I suppose, in being able to conclude a deal of this magnitude and of this size, particularly as it relates to what has been potentially quite a volatile market if we think about the oil market of late.
Well, thank you, Jimmy, and thank you to your listeners, and thank you for having me. Definitely a great milestone for us to be able to conclude this at a time that you talk to the volatility. But I think for us, you know, it's a market where we always know that there will be volatility because it was a commodity market where you're going to have the ups and the downs. And what's important, you know, is to stay consistent in terms of, you know, what your mission is as a business and serving your customers and making sure that you provide the products that they come to rely on as a company.
Aluani, take us through the particular numbers around the deal with ADNOC. $1 billion is always a nice round number to refer to, but obviously looking at this particular context, there's a lot of valuations that go into the assets that accompany this particular sale and this transaction. Take us through some of the nuts and bolts around this particular transaction.
It's a significant transaction in terms of its financial value. And based on, you know, the value that the business then holds. And Shell Downstream South Africa has been operating for a number of years. We have built a network of, you know, petrol stations all over the country, well located, that serves our customers. We've built a brand over many, many decades throughout, and loyal customer base. And we've come to be relied on in terms of, you know, premium fuels that are quality fuels and the service that we provide to our customers. And so when evaluation is done, you have to take all that into account in terms of the brand value, in terms of the footprint that you have in the country and the output that you then have in that output. But that $1 billion, as it were, is the total amount, obviously excluding any net debt that the business carries.
Aluani, can we take a look at the position that this then puts Shell in after the fact? I mean, this is a deal that was initially announced back in May of 2024. We'd been looking for the right suitor since then, and we'd had a couple of conversations with potential suitors. Now that the deal has been concluded, we know that some of the payments will be deferred, and there's going to be a couple of I's to dot and T's to cross. Where does that leave Shell as a business after this transaction in South Africa?
So Shell in South Africa, we have always been operating two main businesses, which is our downstream business, which is really in scope for this transaction that we are talking to, and then the upstream business that we have. And so we'll continue to be a partner for South Africa, you know, where we see value and capabilities really aligning. And if you think about our upstream experience and capability, it's well known globally. And we believe that we'll bring to bear those capabilities, and we should be able to continue to invest in that space. And it's an exciting space because it's a space where our offshore space is really underexplored. We do not know what we do not know in terms of, you know, how much oil reserves or gas reserves do we have, and whether or not we can be able to extract those resources in a sustainable way and commercially viable way. So we'll continue to be part of South Africa and the fabric of society. And even in the context of this transaction, the Shell brand will remain in country. So therefore, our customers, I need to really reassure them that the Shell brand will remain, and also reassure them that the products that they've come to rely on from Shell, such as V-Power and Helix and other brands that we have, will continue to be here in the same quality that they've come to rely on.
Aluani, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the empowerment aspect of the particular transaction. Around 28% of the South African business, once sold and finalized, would expect it to be sold on to an empowerment partner in South Africa's case. Was this a critical component of putting this deal together? And from a Shell perspective, when you mention that the Shell brand will continue to remain in South Africa, are we saying that we're not going to rebrand this, or are we saying that in other respects Shell will continue to have a presence in South Africa?
So to answer maybe your last question around the Shell brand, we are saying we're not going to be rebranding the stations. So the Shell brand that you see in the stations is going to continue to be there in terms of the long-term agreement that Shell and the ADNOC Group have. And then when you're talking about the transformation element, I think it would be very amiss of us to would have entered the transaction without taking into account the country that we live in, that has a history of, you know, inequality, and therefore still wanting to play our role in expanding access and getting more people involved in the business. And it was really a critical element of the deal to say the new investor coming in should be well aware that they will be required to then have, you know, a triple B element to this transaction in order for it to be a successful transaction, but also contribute to the transformation journey that this country has been on.
South Africa continues to remain on its transformation journey, but alongside that continues to attract investment, and investment in good assets. And that is why the team at the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company saw the Shell downstream assets and thought they'd pay $1 billion for that quite easily. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. All the best to you, Aluani, and the team in terms of taking this transaction forward and getting everything else over the line. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Country Chair for Shell Downstream South Africa, Aluani Museisi, joining us to take a look at their conclusion of their sale of the Shell assets that had been on the market for a little over 2 years.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This morning, National Treasury put out a release confirming that 70 municipalities in South Africa would have funds withheld to them as a result of not meeting the requirements that National Treasury had previously set out for these stakeholder funds to be released to them. Amongst those municipalities is the city of Johannesburg. Now, we know that this is off the back of promises made by National Treasury where it relates to budgets of municipalities and how it is they intend to enforce administration and ensure that municipalities get back on the right track. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the director for the School of Economics and Management at the University of Limpopo, Professor Samuel Koma. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Prof Koma, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. National Treasury, and particularly the minister, promises made, clearly promises kept.
Yes, in fact, it should be pointed out that the decision taken by the National Treasury is unprecedented since the existence of the local government system in the country. However, it is a necessary decision, and in fact, it's a decision that is informed by the Auditor General's reports looking at the performance of municipalities in terms of municipal audit outcomes. And in fact, she has indicated, that is the AG, that the situation facing many municipalities is very dire and require decisive and turnaround action to be taken. So the National Treasury, through this decision, it has exercised its constitutional power, which allows the National Treasury to stop the transfer of equitable share grants to municipalities that have committed serious or persistent breach with the applicable law. In this instance, would be the Municipal Finance Management Act. So that is the context that informed the decision taken by the National Treasury. And in fact, the National Treasury says this is not a punitive measure. It is a corrective measure we're putting in place to force these municipalities to begin to exercise fiscal discipline and ensure that there is proper management of taxpayers' funds through, of course, ensuring that there are strong internal controls and also they are able to take decisions around consequence management and ensuring accountability.
Prof Goma, did the National Treasury have any other alternative in this particular case? I mean, I'm looking at the municipalities listed here, and as you rightly mentioned, this is persistent non-compliance with the Municipal Finance Management Act. In this situation, as you refer to it as unprecedented measures taken by National Treasury, did they really have any alternatives given that the municipalities have been non-compliant?
Yes, a great question, Jimmy. In fact, the National Treasury says that over a four-year period, as National Treasury, we have provided guidance and also embarked on support intervention to these municipalities. But to this day, these municipalities have failed to ensure that the action, the guidance they receive from the National Treasury, including the support interventions that they've seen put in place to turn around the situation. So through this decision, in fact, one hopes that municipalities will begin to ensure fiscal discipline and strengthen accountability, oversight and consequence management across the local government.
Prof Gorman, can we take a look at some of the other sentiments echoed by National Treasury? You touched on the fact that Treasury did confirm that this is a punitive measure not designed to be harmful or hurtful towards these municipalities, but rather to get them back on a corrective path. Does this look like a measure that could potentially be in place longer than expected? Or is it one of those where by design, if the municipalities get themselves back on corrected course, they would then not be subjected to this in the future?
You're quite correct, Jimmy. In fact, the National Treasury has given these municipalities 120 days to secure the release of the equitable share grants due to them by, one, demonstrating that they've taken steps to subject municipal officials who have committed this serious breach of the Municipal Finance Management Act and other related legislation. And also they need to demonstrate that criminal proceedings, including civil action to recover funds that are due to these municipalities have since been taken, and the National Treasury says, show cause and furnish us with documentary proof that speaks to this decisive action you've taken as a municipality, including the municipalities having to submit signed payment agreements that involves the Eskom debt, the debt that is also being incurred by the water boards on the part of these municipalities. And National Treasury says, we now also want to see those signed payment agreements to show that you are now committed to turn around the situation facing these municipalities.
Prof Goma, what kind of precedents does this set if we are to look at municipalities like the city of Johannesburg, where, for example, they had an unfunded budget and National Treasury issued a warning ahead of this particular decision, to which the city of Johannesburg did not heed that warning? Does this sort of action then remind municipalities throughout the country that National Treasury has got constitutional powers it can enforce, and clearly they are willing to enforce them if necessary?
You're quite right, Jimmy. And this is the call we've been making, that it is high time the National Treasury begin to take decisive steps in intervening in the financial affairs of municipalities that have consistently failed to adhere to legislation in terms of compliance. And this is also the part that has been lamented by the Auditor General on several occasions, to say there is just sheer and blatant disregard of the law, and many municipalities that don't want to comply with the law, especially around issues of procurement and other related financial aspects. So it's a wake-up call for all municipalities, and we can only hope that these municipalities will now ensure that there is proper fiscal discipline, and where there is deviation with the law, they are able to take decisive action to recover funds and also deal with issues of unauthorized, irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure.
Well, the Minister in the Department of National Treasury did commit to dealing with the fiscal challenges that plague South Africa. This is one of them. It has been one of them that has plagued not only the national budget, but also organizations like Eskom. And this unprecedented measure, hopefully getting the message across that we need to address these issues more urgently and more seriously. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Professor Samuel Koma of the University of Limpopo joining us to take a look at National Treasury's decision to withhold the equitable share of its contributions towards municipalities that remain non-compliant.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So if you remember at the start of the year or towards the end of last year, coming into this year, there was a huge conversation around the global minimum tax as an international framework that was established by the OECD and the G20 to better manage how organizations pay corporate tax throughout the world. And South Africa adopted that global minimum tax framework. Of course, our minimum tax rate for corporates sits well above the 15% minimum threshold that was set in place. But a recent World Bank conversation has emerged where the World Bank has suggested that South Africa employ a similar structure from a taxation perspective where it relates to special economic zones. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with Distinguished Professor for Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Prof Bond, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. I thought the whole purpose of special economic zones was to enhance and encourage trade.
Yes, and special is the most important word. An economic zone can be a sort of sovereign place where you, as a company, you don't pay very high tax, you don't worry about labor or environmental. That's the Chinese secret. That's where industrial development zones and SEZs really got their start, Shenzhen especially. Now, in South Africa, the original IDZs, especially the very first and, you know, still today the biggest, Kucha, outside Gqeberha, and that one has been particularly connected to the auto industry with two Chinese companies, First Auto Works and Beijing Auto Industrial Corporation. Then we have Dube, just at the Durban airport, the King Shaka. And the biggest new one, with everyone's worried about, could be as much as $10 billion, 170 billion rand of investment at some point. That's the Messina Makado Special Economic Zone. And there are another dozen or so, and they CZs in Trani and the Atlantis. And, you know, there's lots of things that are out there called SEZs. Not everyone working in them gets the 15%. That seems to be what the World Bank wants to bring more investment into the SEZs.
Professor Bond, just to be clear, are we looking to increase the taxation in these zones? Are we looking to decrease the taxation in these zones? How are these special economic zones currently set up in South Africa in particular?
Well, our broader corporate tax rate, 27%, it's kept coming down, 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 with the hope that that incentivizes new investment. The peak was about, I think it was 52.5, if I'm not mistaken, in 1992. The apartheid regime was really needing that corporate tax. And then Mandela and Mbeki, even Zuma, and Ramaphosa, they've cut it, and now it's 27. So it's a big set of tax cuts with the anticipation, with the logic that if you lower the tax, you get more investment. That actually hasn't happened. We've had especially sort of an investment strike from big business, aside from some of the mining industries where it goes up and down. And the exception might be especially Kucha, and to some extent Dube, and now Messina Makado. There are big investments planned. And the question is, are they genuine and are they going to have multipliers? Will they help to get other investors in? Will they draw on the local economy? There's a huge controversy, and even the Gqeberha Chamber of Commerce is angry that the two Chinese companies are doing import of you know, basically knockdown kits. They just screw them up together for those first auto works, Beijing Auto Industrial Corporation. So they're not really good investments. Dubé similarly has some controversies. The big phone company, Mara, failed. And the biggest, probably the biggest fight is going to be very close to where Cyril Ramaphosa grew up, his high school, very close to Messina Mercado. Your listeners may know that's, if you go over Louis Trichardt, the mountain, Südbrandsburg, you come to this sort of, let's say, baobab zone, you know, thousands of baobabs. They're being chopped, and coal is being dug by a Chinese company that took over MC Mining. And they hope that they're going to then turn that coal into ferrochrome steel and, you know, be successful way up there, where there's pretty much nothing already. It's about an hour south of the Zimbabwe border, south of Messina. Wow, these are, you know, I mean, $10 billion claims. You know, they're not really going to, you know, pan out. None of these SEZs really do work. They just give big companies big tax breaks, 15%. And I don't think that's, you know, particularly healthy, because especially when it's coal in Messina Mercado, hey, there's a climate catastrophe. We actually have to leave that coal in the hole.
Professor Bond, can we take a look at the special economic zones and compare them to some of the other initiatives that are put in place? I mean, we know we've got initiatives like government subsidies that are being provided to international companies that come into South Africa. I think of one such example in the automotive sector, where we're incentivizing international automotive companies to set up their assembly plants and factories in South Africa via subsidies. How do we strike the balance between using the subsidies as a tool to attract that investment and commitment into the country and doing it via special economic zones? Is there a distinct difference? Are there distinct benefits? And should we be weighing up one versus the other as a mechanism?
Jimmy, it's a tough question because the situation is fluid. And the reason it's fluid is partly Donald Trump. You remember his tariffs that hit us so hard from February, and then especially his anti-South African hits. I mean, he's been trying to protect the U.S. car industry. So from 2024, exports of 26,000 vehicles to the U.S. in 2024, then it went down to about 6,000. And then the other big factor, the Chinese and Indian cheap car invasion, and those have really displaced local production. So I must say, if we're spending, you know, around 40 billion rand a year from the fiscus on export subsidies for automobiles, and we still aren't really producing any electric vehicles, and then we get climate catastrophes, and the Durban rain bomb in 2022 smashed the Sabingo factory of Toyota. About 4,000 cars were lost, and then, you know, sort of Durban has to now foot the bill not only for, you know, new rainwater, you know, sort of storage, the pumping, the rainwater that has to be moved away from Toyota, but now the insurance company of Toyota is suing Durban. To me, it looks like a bit of a disaster that we've basically put way too much emphasis on subsidization of these big companies and not getting very much in return. Certainly jobs, certainly new investment isn't as high as we want. And now we've got these import waves, and the metal workers union, the main union, and some of the auto producers, they're demanding tariff, you know, 100% tariffs on the Chinese and Indian imports, which have gone from about 2% to nearly 50% of South African local consumption. I even myself bought well, I won't say the name brand, but it was, I thought it was made in Isipingo. Nope, made in India. I didn't know that. So these are the sorts of problems that an economy like ours has, being way too dependent upon international commerce and not yet having the protections we need.
Protections are needed. Our economy, however, does need to keep growing and need to have some level of investment in order for that to be achieved. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond, joining us to take a look at the special economic zones in South Africa and the latest proposal by the World Bank. They should incur a 15% tax rate.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Department of Trade, Industry and Competition has announced that they would be looking to potentially make amendments to the existing gambling legislation that exists in the country in an effort to curb the gambling concerns that have been raised over the last couple of months around the state of online gambling and some of the interventions that might be required around that. We're going to be taking a look at these proposed amendments in some detail with the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board, Lungile Dukwane, joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Lungile, lovely having you on our show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with an overview of what some of these proposed amendments include. I imagine as the regulatory body responsible for enforcing the legislative changes, you would have some idea of what the DTIC has proposed here.
Well, thank you, Jimmy, and thanks for having us. One of the issues that we have been looking at, I think, from the National Gambling Board perspective, had been some of the deficiencies that are in the National Gambling Act of 2004, in the sense that number one, it does not allow online gambling. I think that's the first aspect. We call it interactive gambling. And broadly, there has been some deficiencies in relation to how we work together with the provinces as a concurrent function and some of the areas to enhance enforcement in relation to gambling broadly, including advertising. So we, of course, know that the DTIC, as our mother department, are actually dealing with the legislative elements. One of those is the issue of the national gambling policy that they're actually developing, and they're working together with ourselves as NGP, but also they're working with the other provincial licensing authorities in order to make sure that whatever we come up with in the industry, it's actually something that is workable. It's something that is going to give us the results that give us and society where there's no overstimulation, but also where we can be able to reap the economic benefits and manage the socioeconomic issues that may arise out of that. So there's been work that has been going on, and we've been engaging with some of the work, I think, at the various committees that we actually have internally and with the various responsible committees externally.
Speaking of responsibilities, Lungile, you and I caught up towards the tail end of last year trying to take a look at this gambling crisis and seeing whose responsibility it was. When we spoke about this, we briefly touched on the gambling advertising aspects of it, and I see that that has become quite the focal point of some of the amendments that are being proposed here. If we draw back to that conversation and perhaps look at what's happening here now with the advertising amendments, how do we look to potentially approach the advertising aspects of gambling in South Africa? Understanding, of course, that these are just potential options at the moment and nothing has been set in stone.
Well, in essence, Jim, I think that we were mandated, I think, by the NGPC to go and work on what we referred to as the norms and standards on gambling advertising. Of course, out of the concern that the proliferation of gambling is actually increasing the prevalence of gambling in the country and the negative effects of that gambling. So indeed, we went as the NGP to work on those norms and standards, which we have subsequently developed on ourselves, and that is supposed to be passed through the NGPC and for the finalization by the minister in order to make sure that those amendments take place. Part of what we are dealing with are the aspects, for example, to say at what spaces there should be gambling advertisement, what kind of the requirements, for example, for responsible gambling messaging that goes with that, and what percentage of that should be responsible gambling messaging, and the spaces and where should you advertise in terms of the licensing and the conditions that should go with that. It also goes to the issues of looking at when the advertising may actually take place. Of course, that is going to be the subject of the NGPC and the finalization by the minister in terms of those aspects.
Lungile, another aspect of the current National Gambling Amendment Bill that sits before Parliament for approval includes potentially repositioning the NGB as a more official regulator of the gambling landscape. Can we take a look at that and take a look at what that would empower the NGB to do where it relates to enforcing some of the suggestions and proposals that have been put forward here?
The National Gambling Amendment bill that is in front of Parliament, one of the proposals that actually there is that the NGP should be empowered in terms of the enforcement powers, where its own inspectors can be able to go directly to the provinces in order to monitor any aspect that is viewed as non-compliance without necessarily having to go through the province. That would actually enhance the working relationship between those two and make sure that the challenges that emerge as a result of non-compliance are actually dealt with. But also it's opening up around the aspects of establishing what we call the NSEMs to be expanded to all of the other modes in terms of monitoring, a central monitoring system, because as you would know that we're only monitoring one mode now, which is the LPMs. The intention of that is to make sure that we expand it to all of the other three remaining modes that we actually have in the country. So that would assess, but also there's an expensive element that we call the unlawful winnings, which is section 16 of the Act, where, for example, if you have gambled illegally, the NGP confiscates that money and they have to go to high court in order to get that authority to or court order to confiscate that money. The Act actually does away with that element because it's quite an expensive one for NGP. So when we confiscate that money, we don't need to go to the high court anymore. It's something that can be dealt with at the level of the NGP and that money forfeited to the state.
Lungile, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the social and financial impact that the current gambling crisis is having on our economy. We know that research suggests that there is a direct correlation between financial distress and gambling activity. And given the level of increased gambling activity we've seen in the country, I want to explore what we're aiming to achieve here from a regulatory standpoint by addressing some of these issues and concerns.
Well, obviously, one of the key contributors we think to gambling is the first element we've already discussed, which is the issue of the proliferation of gambling advertising. I think that's the first one. The second one is an element that relates to elements of unemployment and some believing that they can do gambling as part of their income generation, which we have believed that for some time. We must spend a lot of time educating those would-be gamblers in order to make sure that they do it as part of entertainment. So part of what we is coming up now is to make sure that there's proper regulation, there's alignment between the regulation and what is actually being done at the level of the operators and the provincial licensing authority. That is the direction that is being taken to make sure that we manage that. Of course, Jimmy, this issue of gambling now has gone beyond just being the responsibility of just the NGP or the DTIC. It goes beyond. It's a societal problem now. And it needs all of us to mobilize all sectors of society to make sure that we deal with this challenge that we have, because SARGF alone, in terms of the counseling that they do, it would not be enough for them only. So it needs society to make sure that they have the necessary controls to work together in dealing with those ones, and the agencies of government to work together to build solid measures that are going to make sure that we prevent the unlicensed gambling and the measures that are going to make sure that we are able to confiscate whatever the offshore gamblers are taking from our own country and from our own economy and deal with some of those things. That's why we've gone out on the expression of interest as the NGP to deal with that issue, to make sure that we are able to block all of the foreign offshore operators that may be operating in our space.
Illegal operators and a problem that stretches beyond just the pockets of South Africans. This is something we need to deal with and handle with the utmost importance. We will leave the conversation on that note for now. Lungile Dukwana, Acting Chief Executive Officer at the National Gambling Board, joining us to take a look at the latest proposals being put forward on how to better regulate and govern South Africa's gambling space.
The Property Pod, hosted by me, Suren Naidu, is South Africa's premier property investor podcast. On this weekly MoneyWeb show, we gain insider insights from leading executives, analysts, developers, and entrepreneurs in the country's dynamic real estate sector. The podcast features diverse guests and offers in-depth coverage on the South African property scene, also featuring as a video on MoneyWeb TV on YouTube. Listen to the Property Pod weekly on moneyweb.co.za, podcast platforms like Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcast for the latest industry insights and developments.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto, and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Merchants by trade, explorers by heart. Go beyond with Merchant West. For many South Africans, owning commercial property, especially if you are running your business out of that commercial property, could have some really powerful implications for your business and for your strategy. We're going to be taking a look at commercial property ownership in a bit more detail with the team at Merchant West. I'm joined on the line by the head of property finance and working capital solutions at Merchant West, Rico Stradom, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Rico, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start the conversation perhaps with the importance of property ownership for businesses in particular, and what sorts of strategic advantages this potentially presents for businesses.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. It's only a pleasure. I think owning your property in South Africa versus renting, there's such a wide benefit that you actually can look at. It strengthens really your balance sheet position. It's turning an occurring expense, increasing annually, into an investment on your property, rather paying your own property, investing in your property, than paying an equity into your landlord's property, essentially.
But Rico, business owners would quite easily argue that commercial property is expensive, and that's probably one of the biggest barriers preventing property ownership. How do we approach that, or how should businesses approach the barriers that confront them where it relates to commercial property ownership?
I think timing the property can cut both ways. So the right property doesn't wait for a convenient moment to come to the market. I think opportunities suddenly arise. Having the expensive nature of commercial properties in a business, you can bridge a gap parting with the right funding partner. I think with Merchant West offering a flexible, suitable solution to the commercial property or to the businesses on commercial property will be key to bridge that gap, to have a solution structured that is right for your business, for the transaction, and actually for the business cash flow. I think that's where we want to bridge the need, structure solutions meeting the customer's need rather than providing a solution that is a checklist from a traditional institution, possibly.
Rico, can we take a look at some of the other benefits of commercial property ownership for business owners? We know that in the residential space, in the private space, property ownership is a strategic tool for wealth creation. Is this the same case for businesses? Can this be the same case if businesses are to approach it from an ownership perspective?
Yeah, certainly. I think from a rent expense, it's always more expensive than paying rent versus owning your own property. You can see it still as a strategic investment. I think South African businesses are more focused on growing their operations and growing wealth into their business rather than focusing on the wealth that possibly sits tied up in an expense line in the business. So where specialist financiers structured deals around the business actual operations, I think the key is to really have the right structure, and that will create possibly wealth just outside of your normal operation business.
Rico, let's talk about where businesses like Merchant West fit in to these types of transactions. Property transactions, by their very nature, are long-term transactions. They are very high-value transactions, and commercial properties at that, exponentially higher than some residential properties in some cases. How then does a team like Merchant West come to the assistance of businesses to support them in structuring these deals? Because I can imagine the structuring aspect of it is equally as important as things like the financing and the ownership.
So from a Merchant West perspective, we are uniquely positioned to offer these flexible commercial property solutions to qualifying customers. How we structure it is how we assist our customers will be with the flexibility of the structure. So offering higher loan to values, reduced deposits is some of the key elements we use. From escalations in the property, we look over a 10-year transaction. So the nature of aligning the funding with the property requirement is crucial to ultimately give the client the most for the solution to fit the business, and then to structure it accommodating all the requirements of the business. I think from a Merchant West perspective, we are merchants by trade, so we like to we like to think business like a business owner first before we think about a financier. And I think that's crucial to provide a correct solution to our customers.
Rico, before I let you go, we touched on the strategic benefits of considering property ownership as opposed to renting, for example. And one of the benefits that came up as we were discussing this that came to mind for me was that as a property owner, transitioning from a tenant to a landlord effectively then allows you to take on other tenants. Beyond just the property ownership aspect of it all, businesses can now potentially look at this as a new income stream in some respects.
I think from a business side, outside of building your own wealth or your own balance sheet with owning your property, certainly if it's, you can always structure your property in a ring fence property holding company or trust that gives you ownership and freedom to invest in your property for various needs that might arise. There can also then be the option to partially let or lease your property. Depending on growth, you potentially have a larger property that you need to over time grow into. For time being, that can be an asset, income generating asset where you can have a sublease assisting the business for affordability, assisting cost, and also reducing the overall cost of owning your property versus renting a property for extended period of time.
Property ownership, particularly in the commercial sense, could provide some unique strategic advantages and flexibility depending on what it is that your business requires. If you are considering this, reach out to the team at Merchant West. They're more than happy to assist you in taking a look at what it is that you need as a business. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Head of Commercial Property Finance and Working Capital Solutions at Merchant West, Rico Stradom, joining us to take a look at ownership in the commercial property space. If you're still paying rent on your business premises, you're investing in your landlord, not your business. Merchant West offers commercial property finance with up to 100% loan to value, so instead of paying rent, you're building equity in your own asset. For fast approvals and specialists who understand your business, go beyond. Visit merchantwest.co.za. Brought to you by Merchant West, where ambition becomes reality.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
The Property Pod, hosted by me, Suren Naidu, is South Africa's premier property investor podcast. On this weekly MoneyWeb show, we gain insider insights from leading executives, analysts, developers, and entrepreneurs in the country's dynamic real estate sector. The podcast features diverse guests and offers in-depth coverage on the South African property scene, also featuring as a video on MoneyWeb TV on YouTube. Listen to the Property Pod weekly on moneyweb.co.za, podcast platforms like Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcast for the latest industry insights and developments.
Africa.
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 If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzi Leramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha
on SAFM.
And that's the update for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you know exactly where you can catch up on them. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Dino Mutaung and the SAFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news. They will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.